Young, it's Here and Now. Coming up, journalist George Packer on Iraq. But first, major news on breast cancer. A new analysis reveals that breast cancer rates in the U.S. fell dramatically in 2003. And the report strongly suggests the decline can be traced to the number of women who abruptly stopped taking hormone replacement therapy in 2002. They stopped because another study, the 2002 Women's Health Initiative report, linked hormone treatment with an increased risk of breast cancer. Now, women take hormone replacement therapy to offset menopausal symptoms such as hot flashes, but many older women past menopause were taking it in large numbers to offset bone loss and heart disease until that 2002 bombshell report. Dr. Rowan Chabowski of the Harbor UCLA Medical Center in Los Angeles is one of the authors of the new breast cancer study. And Dr. Chabowski, you've called this new study better than a cure. What are you saying?
It's better for a woman to not have a cancer than to go through cancer and then end up being faced with having a treatment. So in that sense, it's better than a cure, but obviously a cure would be fantastic.
Well, how many fewer cases are you seeing?
In 2003 versus 2002, it would translate out into about 14,000 fewer invasive breast cancers in the United States.
Wow. Well, let's be clear. The women in the earlier study, the Health Initiative study, were from 50 to 79, but many of them weren't taking hormone replacement to offset menopausal symptoms like hot flashes. Many of the older women were taking the HRT, the replacement therapy, for what were thought to be other benefits like fighting heart disease. But that study was abruptly stopped, right?
That is correct. The study was stopped at a time when it seemed like the net bad effects outweighed the net good effects, principally coronary heart disease risk, stroke risk, and invasive breast cancer risk.
Right. And so the breast cancer risk was becoming way too high. Were you surprised, though? I mean, many older women at that time stopped with the help of doctors taking their HRT. But still, this decline, 14,000 less cases in just 1 year. What does this tell us about breast cancer, how fast it can take hold? Or maybe what does it tell us about estrogen, the growth hormone in hormone replacement therapies?
We presented a hypothesis showing an association between this tremendous drop in menopausal hormone therapy use. There was probably about 30 million fewer prescriptions in 2003 versus 2002. We're searching for something that could cause such a dramatic reduction in breast cancer risk. Menopausal hormone therapy is one thing, but if it was the case, it would have to be impacting already existing cancers.
Hey, tell me more about that, because again, that goes to the question, how could that happen so fast in a year? So you're saying what, that the estrogen and the hormone replacement therapies might have boosted a cancer cell already there?
Yes, that's right. And that's why it's an interesting question will be what happens in subsequent years. Is this a one-year delay, or is this at actual cancers that will never come back? The 2004 data will be released in the spring of next year, and that will be an important signal as to whether this is a long-term effect or not.
Well, and again, just to understand that, are you saying that perhaps without taking estrogen, the cancer cells didn't grow and present themselves as breast cancer, but they may still be there and just be slower?
That's a possibility. Again, we're not sure what the etiology is, even if it's hormones. I think the way to get at that question will be when other countries look at their incidence of cancers and their use of hormone therapy and see if they change and see if they see the same patterns.
Right.
So all these questions still remain.
Well, in the meantime, doctor, what should women do? What would you say to an older woman who's through her menopausal symptoms and is still taking the HRT to fight heart disease?
In the Women's Health Initiative, we showed that estrogen plus progesterone at least was associated with an increase in heart disease. So I think the message, which is clear from the labeling of the hormones now, is that they shouldn't be taken for chronic disease risk, they don't reduce heart disease, and if they're taken for vasomotor symptoms, they should take in the lowest dose for the shortest duration possible.
And what about those women in their 50s who are suffering terrible symptoms of menopause? I mean, we learned after the Health Initiative, don't stop cold. But are doctors still recommending women who only take HRTs for a short time should still take them if they need them?
I think the approach would be take it for a period of time, several years, then stop to see whether the symptoms are still present. In many women, the symptoms decline or go away after a period of years, and it's an individual woman who has to see whether her symptoms have gone down enough so that she can feel comfortable in stopping menopausal hormone therapy.
And how would you recommend, doctor, that women stop if they do want to stop? Because we were hearing for a time that you should gradually reduce the intake if you were taking them in your 50s for menopause symptoms.
The actual package labeling indicates that you can just stop abruptly, and that's what we did to those thousands of women in the Women's Health Initiative. However, many physicians in practice prefer tapering and feel that patient symptoms may be better managed in that fashion.
Dr. Rowan Chabowski of the Harbor UCLA Medical Center in Los Angeles, one of the authors of the new study that shows an incredible decline in breast cancer cases in the U.S. after the 2002 report that noted a connection between breast cancer and hormone replacement therapy. Dr. Chabowski, thank you.
Thank you.
A U.S. commander in Iraq said today that tribal leaders and some political groups are turning to terrorists and insurgents for protection because they don't trust Iraqi security forces. Well, journalist George Packer is also concerned about the safety and protection of Iraqis, especially those who worked with Americans in the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Packer is author of The Assassin's Gate. It's about Iraq. He covered the war for The New Yorker. And as President Bush continues to formulate Iraq policy, Packer now writes about strategists who've come up with new ways of combating insurgencies by looking at old conflicts. And George Packer joins us now. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Start first with this new word in your article, at least new to some of us, disaggregation. What does that mean?
Well, in the context of what's called global counterinsurgency, disaggregation means that the best way to fight a range of jihadist insurgent movements around the world is not by lumping them all together as a single enemy in a single war with a single ideological framework, but instead to try as much as possible to find the regional and local causes of the insurgencies and to deal with them with a sort of fine, granular knowledge of local societies and histories and grievances so that they don't become part of the global jihad.
You heard that word spoken by David Kilcullen, an Australian anthropologist and trained soldier. Let's learn a little bit about him. He was living in Indonesia, where he learned about how the Indonesian government had defeated a separatist Muslim insurgency in the 50s and 60s. He came to the conclusion that they did, that people don't get pushed into rebellion by ideology. They get pulled in by their social networks, as you were saying, their cultures. What do you mean? What did he mean by that?
Well, he found in West Java, where he did his dissertation research as an anthropologist, and he's also a lieutenant colonel in the Australian Army, he found that the same families, the same individuals even, who had originally been insurgents in the 50s and 60s in a movement called Darul Islam, which was mystical, it was local, it was xenophobic, have come back and joined Jamaah Islamiyah, which is an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Southeast Asia with a global and a Salafist outlook. In other words, ideologically, entirely different, but the same people. And his conclusion from his research was it really is less about what they're thinking than about who they're with and what kind of history and social patterns exist there. And because of that, it sort of makes it a little easier to think about how you might dissuade people from joining jihad or might pull them out of it. And he compares it to helping young men leave gangs. You have to find alternative structures, alternative social networks, alternative reasons for existing. And it's not easy work, and he's really just at the beginning of thinking through what kind of counter strategy we might have. We are years behind the jihadists in thinking about this stuff, but at least there's someone who is now on loan at the State Department as a strategic thinker on counterterror who's actually coming up with what I think are some pretty compelling, fresh ideas.
This is David Kilcullen, who had, through a series of just chance conversations, is now working under Condoleezza Rice at the State Department as a strategist. Through him, you've met other anthropologists. I'm thinking of Montgomery McFate. She tells you the same thing. She found this true in Northern Ireland, that insurgency runs in families and social networks.
That's right. She also has a PhD in anthropology. She spent several years in Northern Ireland, spending a lot of time with sympathizers of the Irish Republican Army, and found that, again, insurgency ran in families and in social networks, and that the British government, unlike the United States, understood some of these patterns and did not play into the hands of the enemy's strategy the way I think we've been playing into Al-Qaeda's hands, and did practice a kind of disaggregation where they tried to appeal to different elements of that insurgency in different ways and not lump them all together as a single undifferentiated enemy that required a single strategy. But this was because I think the British knew a lot more about Northern Ireland than we know about Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq.
But then you also write that there's sort of a fly in this theory, ointment, if you will, that Indonesia used the same techniques that they used in the 50s and 60s to fight the Timorese separatists in the 90s, but this time it didn't work, and you cite globalization and the information revolution.
Yeah, Kilcullen actually was part of that in the sense that he was a member of the Australian intervention force that came into East Timor in the late 90s and essentially prevented an Indonesian genocide of Timorese and led to the independence of East Timor. And what he found was the same rather harsh tactics that had succeeded in West Java in the 50s and 60s when no one was looking failed in East Timor in the 90s because of a very sophisticated international propaganda campaign by the Timorese rebels and because of global media coverage. And Kilcullen concluded that the globalized information is the key element in insurgency today, and the insurgents in places like Afghanistan and Iraq are well aware of that, and in fact that drives their strategy. It is the main line of operation, whereas Kilcullen says we don't get that yet, and that's why we're losing.
Well, and some would say the battles are being lost in some of these different insurgencies because the insurgents are right. The classic doctrine about counterinsurgency was thought to be set out by the Malayan Emergency, 1948 yeah. through 60. The British fought there, and they had the attitude as well that less military force, more political and economic help for the people who live there. But we've also spoken with Carolyn Elkins, the journalist who covered the Mau Mau insurgency in Africa, and she says that the Malayan counterinsurgency launched by the British, as well as fighting the Mau Mau in Africa, used extreme violence, and that's part of the equation that's being left out.
Well, I don't think anyone's leaving it out. It's more like correcting the balance. Yeah, absolutely. The British used coercion. They used lethal means. There's no way to win an insurgency, to defeat an insurgency without that, because insurgents will use those means, and the population will feel utterly compelled to take their side. I mean, you can't do it with an approach that some of the NATO commanders in Afghanistan are taking, which is to say, perform good works, and then hope that leads the population to take your side. There's just too much pressure coming from the other side. And, yeah, these are ugly things. These are bloody wars. They're not development campaigns, and they're not missionary work. But on the other hand, the United States has a very hard time fighting insurgencies because our model for war is overwhelmingly military and conventional, and that's driven the war on terror since September 11th. And I think Kilcullen is saying the very model of war on terror has led us to an overwhelmingly military response. He proposes the alternative model of a global counterinsurgency, which immediately tells you that military means are about 20% of your operations, and the rest is what you just described, and we have been woefully behind the curve on the other 80%.
And then we need to fix the broken relationship between the government and the discipline of anthropology, a relationship that broke in Vietnam. We're talking with George Packer, and we'll ask him more about this new thinking on the part of some strategists who've made their way to the White House. And is the thinking too late? George Packer, author of The Assassin's Gate, also an early supporter of the war. We want to ask him about that and about the friends that he's left behind in Iraq, how he fears for their safety. All of that coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with author George Packer, who's been writing extensively in The New Yorker about new thinking, about new strategies, because of some strategists he's met who are thinking about new ways of fighting the war on terror as a global counterinsurgency as opposed to the war on terror. And George Packer, you spoke to David Kilcullen, the Australian who's now made his way to the White House and is getting some
the
of these...
State Department, actually.
I'm sorry. That's what I meant.
I think he would like to make his way, some of his ideas into the inner circle of the White House, but that hasn't happened.
Right. He's in Condoleezza Rice's office.
Yeah, and he works under a guy named Hank Crumpton, who was the CIA's main guy during the overthrow of the Taliban and who's now the chief coordinator on counterterrorism at the State Department.
Well, and the thinking is that we think more anthropologically about the peoples. And I'm struck when I hear this from you that in the early days before the invasion of Iraq, we spoke to analyst Anthony Cordesman, and his words always ring in my ears. He said, well, the effort might work if, in fact, there's a second force that comes in after the invading force to do just what you're saying, know more about the needs of the community. And that never happened. I'm just curious, given your early support of the war, what do you think now about the idea that this thinking never disseminated?
Well, as I said before, it really runs counter to the military culture of the United States. I mean, after Vietnam, the U.S. Army took one lesson to heart, and that was, we will never do that again. And they literally expunged counterinsurgency from courses at West Point. One counterinsurgency expert said to me that the average cadet at West Point knows more about Gettysburg than about Vietnam. We simply willfully denied the memory of it because it was such a painful one, and because it really doesn't suit the American desire for wars to be big, spectacular, and short, and to end with articles of surrender. That's not what insurgencies are like. But I think there are more and more people in the military today, especially because of the disaster of Iraq, who are realizing that they have to change the culture of the Army. There's a new field manual coming out from the Army and Marine Corps that shows a lot of thought.
It's coming out today, in fact.
Yes, exactly. But these guys remain outliers. I really don't think that the Pentagon and the White House have accepted this, and because it is really it asks for a lot of sacrifice from the military and from the society at large. Because remember, civilians are a huge part of counterinsurgency, and they are a tiny fraction of our effort in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's like the soldiers are out in front of the rest of our country because they have been on the receiving end of the pain of these insurgencies, and they know what they don't know, and they're turning back, literally turning to anthropologists like Montgomery McFate for help and saying, we don't understand Iraqi society. We know that's partly why we're killing people and getting killed. Can you help us?
Right. Montgomery McFate, the anthropologist that you also met, and you spoke with anthropologist and Australian Colonel David Kilcullen, who, as we said, is now at the State House and is now getting some of this across, the idea that people don't join these insurgencies because of ideology, but because of networks, much as you said, like young men out of work join a gang. But you ask him, so if this thinking, is it too late to institute this thinking? What was his answer?
Well, he is temporarily an official in the U.S. government, and he's not going to tell me that it's too late in Iraq. I think it's too late in Iraq, and I imagine that he may well think that, and that a lot of people in the government think that. Iraq is a civil war. It's chaotic. We have very little leverage. We have been undermanned from the beginning, under-resourced, and we're not wanted. I mean, we're essentially the organ transplant that's been rejected, and it's extremely difficult to win back the support of a population, not because they like you. This is Kilcullen's idea. Not because they like you, but because they see that it's in their interest to support the government side in the war. Well, I think it's too late for that.
Well, but he did say to you that this idea of disaggregation, what we've been speaking of, is to the jihadi insurgency what containment was to the Cold War, that there is a precedent for a long war, for sort of a waiting it out in a way.
Yeah, well, for a war, and he does analogize to the Cold War.
And containment, by the way, I should throw that word.
Yes,
yeah.
And I think disaggregation is not a strategy that we can pursue in Iraq. It is a strategy and a sort of strategic framework to think about the larger war against jihadism in its various manifestations. And there, I think Kilcullen does have a good idea. Just as containment provided a kind of a guideline for the entire period of the Cold War, and remember, it was argued over. There were people who wanted rollback in the early 50s. They lost that argument. I think similarly, there's going to be arguments in this and in the next administration about whether simply killing and capturing terrorists is the right model to take, or whether we need a more sophisticated one like Kilcullen's. And it is certainly not too late in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and in Somalia and in all the other countries where insurgencies with a radical Islamist outlook are a threat. But the point is, It requires enormous changes in the military and in the civilian bureaucracies, which they're reluctant to make. And it's going to take a president who is really willing to shed some bureaucratic blood in order to get these changes made.
Meanwhile, in about the minute that we have, you've also been writing about the friends in Iraq you left behind with real concern of a sort of, the helicopter struts rising off the building in Vietnam image of these people who supported the U.S. being killed if U.S. troops begin to pull out. We're hearing the Pentagon and the White House are thinking, in fact, of the opposite, perhaps not pulling out troops. But you already know, what, six who have been killed?
Yeah, everyone who's been to Iraq and spent time there has friends who have been killed, especially friends who were killed because of their association with Americans. And to me, it's simply a point of honor that the United States owes those Iraqis who cooperated with us and whose lives are in danger today refuge in this country. And unfortunately, right now, our policy is to make it as difficult as possible for them. And I'm just beginning to explore this and to write about it. But I think it's an issue that's going to be with us more and more. And I'd like to see attention paid, because the situation is quite desperate for people like that in Iraq. And I think we owe them something.
George Packer, author of The Assassin's Gate. He covered the Iraq War for The New Yorker and now has been writing for The New Yorker essays about the friends he left behind and the new ones he's meeting, strategists who are looking for a new way out. What's the word again? Disaggregation.
It's a tough word. It may not catch on with the public, but if people in government at least think about it, then I think that'll be a start.
Instead of the War on Terror, a global counterinsurgency, with more anthropologists in the White House planning what to do. David Packer, thanks as always.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, George Packer, my dear friend. Thanks as always. More ahead, here and now. Funding for Young, it's here and now, and it's quiet on the streets of Santiago today. But earlier this week, Chileans were out in force, largely to celebrate the death of a dictator. Former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet died Sunday. He was 91. Throughout his life, Pinochet successfully avoided prosecution for what happened while he was in power, the torture, disappearance, and murder of thousands of Chileans. Pinochet's death brought back distinct memories for a then young American in Santiago, Mark Cooper, who now writes for Salon, was a press aide to the elected president, Salvador Allende, in 1973, when Allende was overthrown in a coup by Pinochet with U.S. support. He joins us now. And, Mark, I imagine you're thinking of that day this week.
Well, that actually was September 11, 1973, and it's accurate to say for those of us who lived through that or survived it or had friends who survived it or family, that was our September 11. Sometimes military coups come very quickly and neatly. The Chilean one was extremely violent, where there was an immediate deployment of very aggressive troops everywhere around you. There was all the radio and television was controlled by the military instantaneously. Very threatening transmissions were made repeatedly for days, warning people to stay off the streets or they'd be shot on the spot. There were horrific lists of names being read for people who had to turn themselves in. And, of course, there was that iconic moment of the bombing of the National Palace itself. So it is something that is like being in a war, but a one-sided war.
Allende killed himself rather than be arrested. You, as you write, were one of the lucky ones who got out. As we know, thousands didn't, were killed. What was the U.S. role in the coup and the human rights abuses afterwards?
From the time that Allende was about to be elected in 1970, the Nixon White House, with the advice of National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, was that this was just not acceptable. And a number of covert plans were laid by the CIA to overthrow Allende. Once he was in power, there were millions of dollars spent to destabilize the government and to encourage the coup plotters. There's great controversy as to whether the United States had any direct involvement in the actual implementation of the coup on September 11, 1973. That is up for debate. What isn't up for debate is that the United States paid for, financed, organized, and encouraged the forces that supported the coup, and for a number of years, until it became politically untenable, supported Pinochet as well.
And we're reminded that Pinochet was dogged around the world in his later years. So many countries wanted to indict him for crimes against humanity. But Henry Kissinger also has outstanding warrants for his arrest.
Well, that's true. Henry Kissinger is wanted, not necessarily on indictment, but he's wanted for testimony, for possible indictment in several venues, especially in Argentina, related to that period of time. Henry Kissinger, for the last 5 years, has to be very careful where he travels. About 4 or 5 years ago, he came within a hair of getting arrested while being in Paris. So these actions have repercussions that reach out decades later.
We saw pictures after Pinochet died of the people celebrating his death, those who had loved ones killed. But we also saw his supporters holding his pictures and crying. And we know there's, you know, division in Chile. How does the country function? And will Pinochet's death maybe help them move through that division?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's easy to oversimplify, as many media reports have said, the country is divided. In fact, the overwhelming sentiment in Chile is against Pinochet. His opponents have won the last 4 presidential elections and control all of the political institutions in Chile. So Pinochet has been repudiated for years by a large sector of the population. However, there is a minority, it's mostly a wealthy minority, who remember General Pinochet as a guy who would do anything, literally, to defend the interests of this small minority in Chile. And in a perverse way, they're very grateful to him.
And, of course, they would say that he stabilized the country that was in economic trouble.
Yeah, I mean, this is a debate, you know, this is like the old debate that Mussolini made the trains run on time. If one takes that position and says, oh, Chile is a great economic miracle, well, you have to ask yourself, that is achieved by what? By destruction of democracy, by jail, by torture, exile, murder, disemboweling dissidents and throwing them from helicopters? I'm not sure that's a lesson we would want to learn.
We've seen former dictators Saddam Hussein and Slobodan Milosevic tried. What are your thoughts on the fact that Pinochet will not be?
General Pinochet never formally got to sentencing, but the fact is that General Pinochet was indicted on multiple counts. He was booked. He was inculpated, as they say in the Chilean system, which means that he was considered to be guilty by the judges. And I think that human rights advocates can take with them the fact that his legacy was uncovered. He was punished for it. He wound up dying reviled and degraded, and his position in history wound up being what it should be. So there was a modicum of justice achieved with Pinochet.
Mark Cooper, author of Pinochet and Me, a Chilean anti-memoir. He also writes for The Nation magazine and Salon. Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And this note, the Pentagon is rolling out a full honors goodbye for Donald Rumsfeld today. After 6 stormy years as Secretary of Defense, historians will determine if Rumsfeld will be remembered as the architect of a disastrous war. President Bush accepted his resignation right after Election Day, when voters sent a loud message to the White House that they were unhappy with the way the war in Iraq was going. Well, today we recall another Donald Rumsfeld. 3 summers ago, we spoke with author Hart Seeley, who said he heard poetry when Rumsfeld spoke, maybe even a Zen master. Now, here is Donald Rumsfeld in 2002.
The message is that there are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know. And each year we discover a few more of those unknown unknowns.
Well, where some heard defense policy, Hart Seeley heard a poem. He put together many of them. They're called Pieces of Intelligence, the Existential Poetry of Donald H. Rumsfeld. Seeley says Rumsfeld's words, their dedication to the fractured rhythms of the plain-spoken vernacular, are reminiscent of William Carlos Williams. Well, we asked our colleague George Hicks to read Rumsfeld. Here's a statement verbatim. It's called, by Seeley, a confession.
A confession. It's amazing. Once in a while, I'm standing here, doing something, and I think, what in the world am I doing here? It's a big surprise. May 16, 2001, interview with the New York Times.
That's A Confession by Donald Rumsfeld from 2001 as transcribed by Hart Seeley. Donald Rumsfeld steps down as defense secretary today. You're listening to Here and Now. The holiday season can be a difficult time for families who are far apart, and this year, of course, thousands of American families are separated by the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Here now, Shannon Mullen went to a photo shoot in Stoughton, Massachusetts, to see how one man is bringing a few of those families a little closer together.
Very nice. Looking right at me. Very good.
Julie Mandello is sitting alone under a pair of big umbrella lights, having her portrait taken. She's doing her best to smile like she means it. Like she'd smile if her husband was here. Julie married Airman First Class Michael Mandello 2 years ago, but he's been in the Middle East for most of 2006, guarding planes in Qatar.
Really, the hardest part is just the everyday. You come home literally every single night to an empty house. That part gets a little old by about week three, so you just try not to think about it.
Julie sends Michael a lot of photos, but when she packed up the last stack, she realized there weren't many shots of her in it. So this portrait will be his Christmas present.
What's your husband going to do when he sees your picture?
He'll probably cry. It will probably make his whole day. That's really all he's asked for the holidays, is pictures, because he just wants to be there.
Okay, and I'm going to be over here, and you can just look right towards me, and you look great.
The local Knights of Columbus loaned Sean Noonan their meeting hall to set up his makeshift studio. He usually photographs corporate events and college campuses. He says he got the idea to take portraits after reading emails from a high school friend who was serving in Iraq.
And he would only very occasionally get access to email. But when he did, he always spoke about his troops. They were service members who had children being born, children going through milestones of, you know, graduating from kindergarten or going through a dance recital and not being able to see those particular things, and that, you know, they wish they had more of that sort of thing. Now, obviously, I can't do every event that happens to come up, but, you know, hopefully gathering some folks here, we'll go a little ways to providing that kind of coverage.
Susan McManus sends a lot of mail to her husband in Baghdad.
Do you know the address by heart?
Yes, I do.
What is it?
MSG McManus, Paul J, 5358, 382nd Military Police Battalion.
Susan and her daughter Haley talk to Paul a few times a week, and they email back and forth a lot. But having this portrait to hold in his hands, Susan says that'll mean a lot to him.
I think it would just be that a chance for him to feel like a little bit of home. We dress up, we make it special, it feels more like Christmas. He gets to see Haley, you know, how she's growing. It's just our way of saying, you know, we love you, we miss you, and this was just a nice, really, way to do that.
And Haley, if you could sit up here for me. Now, you must be what, second grader?
Third grader.
Third grader. Well, you are very tall.
Sean collected enough donations to pay for the portrait printing services and the postage to get them overseas in time for Christmas.
This has to be a hard time of year, no matter what your religion happens to be. If there's a family member away from home, it's got to be a hard time for them.
Sean won't get into how he feels about President Bush and the war, but he says he hates that people are dying on both sides.
Regardless of what anyone happens to think about the war, the fact is that these guys and women are over there in harm's way, in horrible conditions, and I just felt personally that I had to do something maybe to bring a little comfort. Nice big smiles. I'm sure you've been practicing all day, right?
Watching Sean work, I think about all the things Americans are probably doing around the country right now to support the troops. The Christmas care package campaigns with armies of volunteers in Santa hats, stuffing boxes full of deodorant and DVDs for hundreds, maybe thousands of soldiers. But Sean knows his portraits won't touch anywhere near that many lives. Only a handful of families are even having them done.
I would do it if there was even just one family, you know, if I could make one soldier's day a little bit brighter. You know, I would definitely do it.
Susan McManus says when people like Sean show their support, no matter how small the gesture, it amazes her how much that helps her family get through her husband's deployment.
Even just a simple thing, like you would be surprised, some people will say to me, you know, your husband's in Iraq, thank him for me. I thank you too. And That little thing makes me very happy. Not a lot of people do that. But when they do it, it makes you feel really good.
Right. Big smiles look good. Okay, everybody's looking right here. Right. Okay, let's see how we got going here.
To see photographer Sean Noonan's portraits, go to our website, here-now.org. Our story was produced by Here and Now's Shannon Mullen. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. In the fall of 1973, Yoko Ono kicked John Lennon out of the apartment at the Dakota Building in New York, kick-starting a year-long explosion of Dionysian excess known as Lennon's Lost Weekend. During that year, the former Beatle caroused about L.A. with Ringo Starr, Keith Moon, and Harry Nilsson, among others. Fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on who you ask, this year of excess was captured in the studio, the result being Harry Nilsson's Pussycats record, produced by Lennon and featuring a host of guest stars and musicians.
But I'm so sore from laughing, I haven't got the will to fight.
Pussycats can be charitably described as uneven, a mix of obscure covers and originals that captured the boozy, freewheeling era. The album fizzled upon release and was soon forgotten to everyone, save the wayward Beatlephile. Here and Now's Christopher Blagg spoke with one, Hamilton Lythauser, band leader of The Walkmen, whose passion for the Pussycats has brought the album back. Kind of.
After 30 years of near obscurity, the myth-shrouded Pussycats record has resurfaced. Its champion? Not a nostalgia band from the bloated L.A. scene of the mid-1970s, but a young indie rock band from New York. The Walkmen have released a song-by-song remake of the long-lost Pussycats record. Hamilton Lythauser, the band's singer and frontman, had been obsessed with the Pussycats album for quite some time, but denies making this record by design. In true indie rock fashion, it was more of a haphazard stumble. The Walkmen were finishing up their 100 Miles Off CD in a studio that was set to close in the following weeks. With their tour not starting for several months, the Walkmen had an empty studio and loads of free time, a rare and dangerous situation for any rock band. The stage was set, as Hamilton Lythauser remembers.
The idea was to maybe do some instrumental songs or some covers or something, and we started just doing a couple songs off that record because they're just so fun to play. And I don't know, after a while we got a little carried away and did the whole thing and then decided to put it out. We were just happy with it, and we thought we'd put it out and that some people would be into it and some people would think that we were morons.
But the Walkmen didn't just use the original Pussycats record as inspiration. They recreated the album, note for note, much like director Gus Van Sant's 2001 film recreation of Hitchcock's Psycho.
Sometimes we got a little too close. Sometimes we finish a song and then we'd be like, okay, what was the point of that? You get something like Mucho Mango, that was the song that probably got us all going on it. Anyhow, we all just sort of wanted to record that. Everybody wanted to add their little detail, which is a little something they love in the song. And by the time you're done with it, you know, you got the same thing. You put it on at the beginning, you can't tell the difference between the two.
According to lore, Harry Nilsson ruptured his vocal cords near the beginning of the original sessions, but didn't tell Lennon for fear of him squashing the project. His normally sweet tenor sounds ravaged and hoarse throughout, a detail that Lythauser managed to inadvertently mimic. Here's a clip from the original, Nilsson's cover of Jimmy Cliff's Many Rivers to Cross, followed by Lythauser's version.
I recorded that one actually after we got back from a tour, and I guess I just really been blowing myself out. And I didn't do that on purpose, but yeah, it really came out that way. Vocally, it's kind of weird when you're just trying to imitate someone like that. I didn't mean to, but I guess it really got pretty close.
In order to recreate the madness of the debauched original, the Walkmen gathered busloads of friends and fellow musicians into their studio to help fatten the foursome sound. Saxophones, glockenspiels, kazoos, slide whistles, maracas, and more were added into the cramped, freewheeling studio. At one point, a table saw was used, although Lighthizer insists the degree of difficulty for that particular instrument wasn't too high.
It doesn't take much to play the table saw.
There were even rumors of singers gargling with barbecue sauce to achieve the perfect tonal quality.
That's very possibly true. I don't think I was there for that session.
The studio was a revolving cast of characters and exotic instruments, the one constant being the Walkmen themselves.
We had a big party. Yeah, we had a lot of friends join us, which was fun because we haven't really ever had guest musicians on our record. Every day you'd have a group of like five or six friends that you could play off of, and it was just, you know. And then at the end we had like 50 friends up there to do loop-de-loop.
The Walkmen and their cronies may have been successful in recreating the sound of the Pussycats record, but Lighthizer insists they couldn't have possibly outdone the depravity of those original unhinged sessions.
I mean, it was fun the whole time, you know, having all our friends up there and stuff, but it was probably a little tamer than the original party.
The new version may indeed have been recorded in a slightly milder atmosphere than the original, but it was exactly that decadent, unfettered spirit which attracted the Walkmen to the album in the first place.
It's just got a great vibe. Yeah, sort of Lost Weekend. It's got that L.A. 7, like that Leonard Cohen record, Death of a Ladies Man. It's sort of right in that same vein of Los Angeles overproduced late 70s.
Kind of 70s decadence.
Sleaze. These guys just did it really well and had a really fun take on it.
With both Lennon and Nielsen no longer alive, it's virtually impossible for the Walkmen to get a sense of what the key players in the original recording think of the Walkmen's tribute. That could be a good thing.
I don't know. I'd like to think that they'd think it was fun, but maybe they just think it was pointless and we ripped them off. But, you know, we're not making a dime off it, so.
Such is the case for most vanity projects. Without any publishing royalties or radio-ready singles to push, the Pussycats record may be rich in spirit, but not in actual sales. Strange labors of love like this one aren't exactly tailored to coast up the Billboard charts.
I was just informed the other day that we're not going to be making money with this, basically. I didn't know. I didn't know how it worked, but I didn't know it was like this. We paid for the whole thing up front. I don't think this is their sort of dream come true for a record company.
For the record company.
Well, I'm an old, forgotten soldier. Since they're putting in to war.
Well, it didn't cost us that much to make. It was our studio. We just had to pay all the people to come in and buy all the barbecue every night. You know, that was about $150 of barbecue a night, probably.
Sounds to me like it was worth it.
I'm an old, forgotten campaign hero, left without a cause.
Here now is Christopher Blagg, spoke with the Walkmen's singer Hamilton Lighthizer. For more on their version and the Harry Nielsen original of the Pussycats, visit our website, here-now.org.
I'm an old,
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
In my rusty ammunition has been left out in the rain. I'm an old forgotten part-time.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.